Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us. I'm Jared Serbu, and this is On DoD. Arguably, the biggest defense story of the young year so far is the changes coming to Defense Department as the result of cutbacks to planned spending as a result of last year's debt ceiling deal. DoD will shave just under $500 billion from what it had previously planned in its budgets over the next decade, starting with the 2013 budget, which we'll see in early February. Early this month, President Obama and Defense Secretary Panetta presented the department's strategic guidance, which they say is informing the budgets they'll present over the next few years. The bottom line message, or at least one of them, is a smaller, more agile, but still equally capable military. The Pentagon's expected to start presenting details of what that guidance will mean for the budget later this week. Earlier this week, I talked with George Little, the Pentagon press secretary, and Navy Captain John Kirby, DoD's top uniformed spokesman, about the strategy. Mr. Little, Captain Kirby, thanks for coming on Federal News Radio.
Thanks for having us.
I think a good place to start is probably with the document itself, what it is and what it is not. This is, I don't know, maybe one-tenth the length of the QDR, so I think it's probably fair to say we're not blowing up the 2010 QDR and starting over. What are we doing?
Yeah, this is Captain Kirby. I think what we're describing this as is strategic guidance really to the force. It was not intended to supplant the QDR. It doesn't constitute a new national security strategy. It's a strategy document designed for two things. One, to help us make a little bit better sense of where we are at this inflection point in U.S. military history. You know, we left Iraq. We're transitioning in Afghanistan. We've been at war for 10 years. Lots of security challenges, new that we haven't faced before ahead of us. And we really believe that this is the right time, the opportune time, to take a look at who we are, what we do for the country, and what, if anything, needs to change about that. The other reality, quite frankly, driving some of this thinking is the fiscal environment that we live in, that the rest of the country lives in. In fact, much of the rest of the world. As you know, the president has required and the Defense Department will execute cost savings over the next 10 years of about $487 billion. That's a lot of money. And we wanted to make sure that we found those cost savings in a very measured, deliberate way that was driven by a strategy and not necessarily by mathematics. So that's really what the document is all about.
This is George. Just to piggyback off what John said, this is a strategy-driven process that we're working our way through right now. And the strategic guidance itself reflects the fact that we need to maintain a global presence with our military. We're committed to our interests and allies around the world. We still have threats out there to face. We still have Al-Qaeda that's planning operations against us and our friends. They're diminished, but they're not completely defeated. We need to continue that. We have threats from other countries. We have the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction to worry about. We're still fighting a war in Afghanistan. So we have to keep our eye on the national security ball. We have to do this in a way that allows us to continue to remain the strongest military in the world and to continue addressing the threats. In terms of where the shifts are, my colleague, Captain Kirby, noted that this is an inflection point, and he's absolutely right. We are seeing shifts in strategic focus to the Asia-Pacific region, for instance, and the strategic guidance reflects that. We have an arc of interests and alliances that stretches from Japan down to Australia and over to India. So we're going to be focused on that region of the world. We're not going to take our eye off the Middle East. We're going to maintain a presence in the Middle East in the years to come. And we're going to maintain our security commitments to Europe. All of this recognizing that we need to do our part to contribute to the nation's fiscal health.
You guys have said, and I know Chairman Dempsey has also said, that the military would need to change even absent budget pressure. But to be fair, the main reason this is happening is because budgets are coming down, is it not?
No, well, I think certainly, as I said before, there's a real reality here, a fiscal reality that we're having to deal with. And we wanted to do it, again, from a strategy-led perspective so that it wasn't just about arithmetic and budget cutting for the sake of budget cutting. So absolutely, the fiscal environment that we're in, the $487 billion we're expected to find in savings over the next decade factored into this. But I believe we would have done this anyway, that even if we weren't facing fiscal pressure, this is the right time as we start to transition out of Afghanistan and bring 10 years of war to a close, more than 10 years of war to a close. This is the right time to take a look at what the military is doing, what we could do, we could be doing better, and what maybe we don't need to be doing as much anymore.
So the new buzzword around this strategic guidance over the last couple of weeks seems to be reversibility. Both the Secretary and Deputy Secretary Carter talked a fair amount about that in the briefing earlier this month. Secretary Panetta told us you're designing the reductions you're making so that they can be reversed if need be. How exactly are you doing that? Tell us how that design works.
Sure. Well, the concept of reversibility, in my mind, could be equated to quick mobilization. We are going to see a smaller force. It's going to be smaller, leaner, more agile. It's not going to be weaker. It's a very important point. We're going to maintain our military strength. So when it comes to facing the threats of the future, if we need to augment the force, we're going to do that in a way that it can be done quickly. In the past, we haven't done this kind of downsizing in a way that allows for that reversibility and quick mobilization. And that's factored into this strategic guidance. For instance, the National Guard and Reserve have been incredible over the last 10 years in helping us fight the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and in performing other critical missions. We're going to rely on them going forward as well in terms of reversibility and quick mobilization.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's a great example of what we're talking about here. I mean, but look, as my hero Yogi Berra said, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future, and we've never really always gotten that right. So the idea here with reversibility is to give us enough room inside our own strategy that if we had to adjust, change course, or even completely start anew on something in some area or some function, we can do that. And so mobilization is a great example of that, but I think it applies really across the board.
To get back to the point that George just made about the National Guard and the Reserve, General McKinley, the Guard Bureau Chief, has made a similar point, saying you've got to keep us relevant, you've got to use us. Are there specific plans that we're going to see coming out in this strategy that will do that, that will say how we're going to use the Guard to keep them active and to keep them relevant?
Oh, absolutely there will be. I mean, and we don't want to get ahead of announcements yet to be made here. But look, two points I'd make. One is there is no way that we could have achieved the success we did in Iraq, or we could be achieving the success that we are in Afghanistan or elsewhere around the world without the National Guard and Reserves. They have played every bit a role in what we've done operationally since 9/11 as any of the other service components. Absolutely vital and critical. And we have great respect for the sacrifices that they have made. Point number two, we realize that moving forward, we're going to need to preserve those skills and those capabilities and to make sure that their families get the support they need going into the future. So we're definitely, there is a big place for the National Guard and Reserves. And I think, you know, you see that, look, now the Chief of the National Guard is sitting in the tank with the rest of the Joint Chiefs as a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very tangible example of the great respect we have for them and the contributions that they've made. And we do think that, you know, there's always this balance you try to work between the active component and the reserve about where the skill sets reside, where do the bulk of certain resources and capabilities reside. And the Secretary's made it very clear that he wants to examine that balance carefully and make sure that moving forward we don't invest too much in either one component so that we can't, again, back to George's point about reversibility, make sure we're flexible in the future.
To drill down a little bit more into that reversibility, you know, conceptually, it seems to me that, you know, from the Revolutionary War to Iraq and every major conflict in between, the U.S. military has gotten bigger when it needed to get bigger. How is this different?
What's different about it is we've very openly and in a quite transparent way in this strategic guidance acknowledge the fact that sometimes as a nation, we wait to get in a war before we get ready for it. And this time, we want to avoid that. We want to be open and honest about the fact that predicting the future is not always easy, and we haven't always gotten it right. And we want to have the flexibility built in before we even go down the strategic path to be able to change if we need to.
And does it mean keeping certain types of people while getting rid of other types of people as you do the drawdowns? Can you give me any more specifics on what the plan is there?
I don't think I'd give you a breakdown in terms of skill sets that are more at risk or than others. I mean, the truth is all the services manage their end strength in accordance with requirements and needs of the service. The Air Force and the Navy, and this hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but over the last 10 years, while we have been fighting two wars, largely ground wars, the Air Force and the Navy have managed their end strength quite well and have executed tens of thousands of reductions across the board based on in doing it very smartly, in managing their attrition rate, in managing their recruiting rate, in managing their reenlistment rate, and doing it with a scalpel instead of an axe. And I suspect that that's exactly how the Secretary expects the Army and the Marine Corps to handle it as well. So I couldn't tell you right now, well, this skill set's at risk and this one isn't. There's a lot of factors that go into how we decide how we're going to manage end strength. But the ultimate goal, again, to piggyback on what George says, is to make sure that just because we're smaller doesn't mean we're less capable. Smaller and leaner does not mean weaker.
Mm-hmm. Jared, if I could just make a point on reversibility. And we are going to have a smaller force. Again, it's going to be a strong force, but it will be smaller. And when it comes to drawdowns, in the past we've drawn down too far on the military side. In addition, we've drawn down too far in a way that negatively affects the industrial base of this country. And we can't do that. We need the industrial base. We need a healthy industrial base to preserve the skills and expertise that we need to sustain the capabilities for our military to fight wars and address threats. That's a big deal in this area. I grew up in the D.C. region, and I've seen the growth of the industrial base, and I've seen the contributions it makes. And that's something that we're very sensitive to, and we need to preserve that skill base.
That's George Little, the Pentagon press secretary, along with Captain John Kirby, DOD spokesman. We're talking about DOD's new strategic guidance and how it'll impact budgets in 2013 and beyond. After a short break, we'll talk about the Pentagon's effort to get control of personnel costs, more on the strategic shift to the Asia-Pacific region, and a lot more. You're listening to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Welcome back to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu, and this week we're talking about DOD's recently released strategic guidance, the document that the Pentagon says will influence the new, leaner budget the DOD's expected to start detailing in the next few days and weeks. Our guests are George Little, the Pentagon press secretary, along with Captain John Kirby, DOD spokesman. They talked with me from a studio at the Pentagon earlier this week. Captain Kirby mentioned the Air Force and the Navy, and it seems like the emphasis so far, at least in most of the reporting, has been that the leaner, smaller military, a disproportionate share of that is probably going to come out of the ground forces, and correct me if I'm misinterpreting that. Does that mean concurrent increases in the sizes of the Air Force and the Navy as our focus does shift to the Asia-Pacific region, understanding that you guys can't go into end strength numbers at this point?
Well, when we talk about a leaner military, we aren't just talking about end strength. It isn't just about people. That's a part of what makes an Army, a Navy, a Marine Corps, and an Air Force. But it's not the total sum of it. So when we talk about a leaner force here, we are talking, yes, about end strength to a degree, and certainly the ground forces are going to see some reductions. But we're also talking about programs and capabilities, programs perhaps that aren't performing well and maybe aren't contributing to the overarching strategy, some capabilities that we might want to rebalance a little bit. So when we talk about a smaller or leaner military, we're talking across the board, the capabilities, the actual programmatics, the systems, and of course, to some degree, the people.
President Obama also brought up the idea of getting rid of, I think he called them, outdated Cold War weapon systems. I'm just wondering if there's a working definition inside the Pentagon of what constitutes a Cold War weapon system, because that term certainly means different things to different people. Are there rough contours of how you define a Cold War weapon system that we no longer need?
I'm probably not the expert on weapons programs, so I'm not sure I have a precise definition for you, but there are systems that do outlive their usefulness or their life cycle. And looking at weapons programs, you know, is one part of the decision-making process right now. But the focus is not, as we develop the strategy and make budget decisions, the focus isn't necessarily on specific weapons programs. It's on capabilities and skill sets that we need in the future. Look, technology is advancing, and we know that. We need to keep our technological edge. And so we're viewing this from the prism of strategy and not necessarily, you know, something that was made in 1976 as it outlived its usefulness.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. I think rather than making a list of here are the Cold War systems that don't apply, I think what we're talking about here is we want our systems and capabilities. We want our people to be capable of handling military operations across the spectrum of conflict. And that today is a much wider spectrum than it was when I joined the Navy in 1986. When I joined, I knew exactly who I was being trained to fight. I knew exactly why I was going to sea and what I was going to be expected to do out there. Well, today, you know, our sailors, just for one example in the Navy, are doing everything from counter-piracy to nuclear deterrence and everything in between. And so the whole force has got to stay ready for a broad range of capabilities. And I think that's really the gist of what the president was talking about, that systems and capabilities that are simply focused on only one thing and can only do one thing, can only contribute to one part of the strategy, is probably something that we need to take a look at.
General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said in a speech last week, or maybe it was the week before, that this moment of tightening budgets and strategic refocusing brings as many opportunities as it does liabilities. What are the opportunities here from the Pentagon's perspective?
Moments like this, these inflection points, give us an opportunity to take stock of what we've accomplished over the last several years and where we need to go in the future. So I would completely agree with the chairman in that there are opportunities to look at what challenges this nation confronts going forward, challenges both in terms of national security and our fiscal challenges, and this is a healthy process to go through right now. We shouldn't be in the mindset of static military operations or static national security strategy. We have to evolve with the times. So we have to evolve with the threats, and that's what we're in the process of doing right now, understanding that we are operating in a fiscally constrained environment.
Shift gears just a little bit. Pretty much everyone in a leadership role in the Defense Department has been saying over the past couple of years that personnel costs are something the military has to get control over. You'll obviously see some savings, I guess, in that category just by virtue of having a somewhat smaller force. But are we going to see a serious substantive plan in next year's budget to kind of get your arms around the rate of growth in pay and benefits costs?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the short answer to your question is yes. I mean, personnel costs equate to roughly 60-70% of the Defense Department budget annually. That's a lot of money. And of all the costs that we incur, I mean, personnel costs, above and beyond all the others, rise at a faster rate. And it's a real challenge that we have to try to get our hands around. And, you know, you need people. You can't have a military without people. And those people deserve the best medical care, the best family support, and pay and benefits commensurate with the service and sacrifice that they are rendering the nation. So it's a balance, and we're working really hard to achieve that balance. But it is absolutely something that you'll see reflected in budget documents here going forward.
Such a difficult issue, and I don't think anyone envies the struggle it is to get your arms around those personnel costs. And one of the answers the Secretary has talked about before is grandfathering people into any new changes that happen. I guess one thing I wonder about that is, does that have the potential to be a morale problem in that you could potentially have two folks fighting side by side, one under the existing system of benefits and one under whatever changes are to come?
You're right. On the issue of military retirement, the Secretary has been clear that his strong preference is for a retirement system that allows some grandfathering for currently serving service members. And I think he's committed to that principle. In terms of morale, I might let my military colleague address that, but my sense is that the force understands what we're going through right now and that they understand that we don't want to break faith with them or their families. and that as long as we're straightforward about the future and about what's coming down the pike, they need to they'll understand.
I think what we're going to be very clear about, first of all, there's been no changes to the retirement system.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that the Secretary has said and the Chairman has backed them up, and actually Chairman Mullen before Chairman Dempsey said that it's probably not a bad idea to go take a look, do some kind of study to see if changes to the retirement system can be made or should be made. So, you know, there's been no change right now. If we ever get to a point where there are significant changes made and you'll have in the force people side by side, one under the old system and one under the new, I don't see any morale issue about that because there's no draft in this country. Everybody serving the country is a volunteer. Every one of them makes a decision on their own to join the service and to serve the country. And they do that with complete open transparency by the department about what conditions under which they're enlisting.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. A year ago at this time, the buzzword was efficiency rather than reversibility and strategy. Is the department's view that that drill is basically over as far as finding, you know, $100 billion chunks of money that you can wring out through efficiency? Is that there's no more blood to be squeezed from that stone, and you really do have to change what you do and how you're structured in order to find these big dollar amounts?
That's a key component of what we're going through right now in the decision-making process on the budget. We're not losing sight of efficiencies that can still be achieved. So I wouldn't say that we're done with that at all. We should always be looking for ways to take out redundancy, to take out duplication, to make ourselves more cost-effective. So I think that will be a component of the budget decisions that are made, and that's something that should be done irrespective of a particular point in time or a particular budget. We should always be looking at that.
That's George Little, the Pentagon press secretary, along with Captain John Kirby, DOD spokesman, our guest this week on DOD. We'll have one more segment with him when we come back, followed by some words from General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with his views on the new strategy. First, though, we talk about how the Pentagon will roll out and implement its new strategy for a leaner military. Just ahead on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Jared Serbin. Thanks for listening to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're talking this week about DOD's new strategic guidance, a rough outline of the way the Pentagon and the Obama administration plan to refocus the military after 10 years of war and cut $487 billion in spending over 10 years. Our guests are George Little, the Pentagon press secretary, and Captain John Kirby, DOD spokesman. In this final segment of our interview, recorded earlier this week, we talk about the mechanics of how DOD will implement the strategy and how it intends to get some skeptical members of Congress on board. Is 13 really the pivot point where we'll see all the results of the new strategy all at once, or is this going to be an evolving process over, I don't know, the fight up or over the next 10 years?
We want to implement this new strategic guidance and the cost savings we have to achieve in a way that's measured and that's going to help us protect our nation. We can't do this overnight. We have to make this a gradual process that enables us to keep the country safe while cutting costs. But I will say that if we move into a period of sequestration, and sequestration involves across-the-board meat axe cuts, you can't make choices based on strategy with sequestration. If that happens, then we are looking at instant and rather seismic shifts that could be devastating.
And I think this John here, what you will see, the FY13 budget that will be submitted here very shortly will demonstrate, because every fiscal year's budget has to demonstrate the five-year plan. So you'll see in this budget those first 5 years of the next 10 reflected. So people will be able to track very specifically budget decisions that we're going to be making at least over the next 5 years. To get at that full 10-year cost savings. So roughly $260 billion of the $487 billion that we have to achieve over the next 10 years will be reflected when we submit the fiscal year 13 budget.
One of the issues that kind of blew up after the Pentagon press briefing with the president and the secretary was the notion, at least in some headlines, that the Pentagon would be giving up on the so-called two-war strategy. Do you guys want to talk about that at all and tell me whether or not that's true and if there's a distinction between wars, conflicts, engagements, how you view that?
I think I'm gonna let George jump in here too, but I think you saw in the strategic guidance that it said that we're going to be able to decisively win in one theater, one against one foe, and be able to deter aggressors in any other region. What people are, I think, there's been much ado made here about much made out of this two-war strategy, and that we're somehow through that over the transom, and it's just it's an oversimplification of what the strategic guidance is really all about. The U.S. military has always had to be capable of multitasking. We always have to be able to meet more than one threat at a time. And as I said before, it's very difficult to predict the future. It's very difficult to say now what enemy you might be facing 5, 6, 7 years from now. So what we're trying to do with the strategic guidance is, rather than quantify it quite that overtly, what we're trying to do is just be honest about the actual state of play today. The security environment is far more dynamic than I've ever seen it in my 25 years in uniform. And the military is doing far more tasks than we were back then. And so this strategic guidance reflects that, the diversity of the security challenges and the new types of threats, both economic and even social, and frankly, even from a natural disaster perspective, that we expect we're going to have to stay ready for over the long haul. And I'll let George.
I concur with what John said. And, you know, just to emphasize one of the key points he made, we need to face the full spectrum of threats. This isn't just about preparing for conventional warfare in the 21st century. It's also about facing asymmetric threats like terrorism. So we need to keep our eye on the ball, and we're going to be prepared to address more than one threat at a time. And people, I don't know that we're going to be ready to do that, and we'll win.
So I know that this strategy was the product of months of consultation with the services, with the COCOMs, the entire national security team. You know, one group you allegedly didn't consult with was Congress, at least to hear some of the leadership tell it, or at least in the form of congressional hearings. What's your plan to convince them that this strategy is the right way to go, and that it's not a, a lead from behind plan, as at least one prominent member has called it?
Well, we have certainly at various points consulted on this set of issues with the Congress. We've had dialogue with the Congress, and in fact, it was Congress that assigned us $487 billion in cuts. So this does need to be a dialogue with Congress over the next few weeks and months as we work through the budget process. We need to have a national conversation about what our military is going to do, and Congress is an important part of that dialogue. The Secretary has been clear that that national conversation needs to include not just discussion about the defense budget or other parts of the discretionary side of the federal budget. He believes that we also need to have an honest conversation about the mandatory spending in the federal budget and about revenues. So I think that's something that we look forward to. And, you know, look, we've gone about this process the right way, Jared. We've done it from the perspective not just of straight numbers, but about strategy. We've looked at what the priorities are going forward, what the threats are, and we're making decisions based on that strategy.
And finally, in the few minutes we have remaining, talk me through a little bit, to the extent you can, how you're going to communicate this strategy to other stakeholders, industry, academia, whatever. I mean, I assume you're not just going to drop the 2013 budget document and say that's it. There's got to be more to it. What should we be expecting out of the Pentagon for the next few days, weeks, months?
We realize that it's not just the Congress, but it's also groups around the country, local communities, veteran service organizations, the industrial base. They're going to have questions about this budget, and we're prepared to have that conversation. Just as an example, the secretary met on Friday with some of our industrial partners, not to walk through specific budget decisions at this point because they haven't been announced, mm-hmm. but to emphasize that there needs to be dialogue with them And so I think that's a template for how we view this discussion with our industry partners and with other groups that are going to be very keen on looking closely at the budget decisions that are rolled out.
We've been talking with George Little, the Pentagon press secretary, along with Captain John Kirby, DOD spokesman. Gentlemen, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thank you for having us.
Really enjoyed the time. Thanks for having us.
One more segment of On DOD coming up. Earlier in our interview with Mr. Little and Captain Kirby, I referenced a speech by General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where he said the military doesn't see itself as a victim of this round of budget cuts and that there are more opportunities than liabilities ahead. We'll hear a short excerpt of that speech just ahead on Federal News Radio. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbin. Welcome back to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us. For most of the show, we've been talking with George Little, the Pentagon press secretary, and Captain John Kirby, DOD spokesman, about the new defense strategy. In our final segment, we're going to hear the take of the military's top officer, General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. This is a short excerpt from an hour-long speech he gave at Duke University, his first public comments about the strategic guidance since it was first released at the Pentagon this month. In the speech, which we referenced in our interview, he talks about there being more opportunities than liabilities as the military tries to become leaner and more agile.
I want to make sure everybody knows, the military, are not being victimized by this budget issue. There are some out there speaking about it in those terms, but as I mentioned to you earlier, we clearly have a role to play, all of us as citizens, in helping the nation address its economic crisis. I'm not going to be the only one that goes to the altar and puts something in the basket, don't get me wrong. But I am suggesting to you that we understand that for the nation to overcome its debt crisis and some of the other economic challenges it has, we've got to get a hold of cost as an independent variable in the development of our organizations, our training, our maintenance, and our modernization programs. And we will. But I want to make sure you know we're not being victimized by this. This is something that we, the Joint Chiefs, have embraced as what's best for America, and we'll figure it out. But make no mistake about it, cost is now an independent variable in our decisions about what we will and will not do. And I'll tell you, that's probably the first time in my recent memory that that's been the case. Cost has always been a variable, but it has not, in my recollection, been an independent variable. And it is. And that's okay. It's what faces the nation now, and we will adapt and figure it out. But we can't underestimate the impact of cost. And maybe that's what's among the things that are new in our environment, besides learning the lessons of the last 10 years of war, maybe it's this notion of cost as an independent variable. So what about our emerging defense strategy? First, I want you to know it's a real strategy. It's not just a dusted off, polished off, marginally edited cousin of its former strategies. We've made some real choices. We've taken real ownership of it. And it's a strategy that I would describe as based in it seeks a balance of principle and pragmatism. Principle and pragmatism. It looks out to 2020, so we've already decided what we want to do between now and 17. We dropped the budget. Secretary of Defense will submit the budget for 13-17 at the end of this month, and that will get us through 17, but the work won't end. We're looking to 2020. You might say, why 2020? The mid-future. Well, what's so important about the mid-future? Well, really, nobody wants the mid-future. Go to a cocktail party sometime. Not that you would ever do that. But if you do go to a cocktail party, it's not hard to get somebody to talk about 2050. It's just not. Try it if you think I'm wrong about that. Or get them to talk about what happened today. But ask somebody about, hey, what do you think about 2020? Crickets. And you might say, why is 2020 so intimidating? It's intimidating because we actually have the opportunity to shape it, and we're going to own it. And that's what we need to be thinking about, not what we're going to do tomorrow or on this one budget, but rather what is it that the nation needs in 2020? And we're working on that a lot. And it's some combination of changed relationships between the traditional and conventional military components, the emerging components such as cyber, the lessons of the last 10 years of war, especially special operating forces. It's a new relationship among the services, potentially. That gets at what I said earlier to link the two together about changing the way we approach security challenges, not just by dialing up and down the resources. And I think we got a reasonable chance of doing it. It shifts some geographic priorities. You'll hear famously that we are more interested now in the strategic challenges that are emanating from the Pacific. And if you like, we can talk about that. What it doesn't mean is that we are going to neglect our strategic traditional partners in Europe. It means we have to understand how to engage with them, how to partner with them, how to build their capabilities in a different way than just plopping large amounts and large numbers of U.S. troops on their soil. And we can figure this out. So we will shift our view of where the strategic challenges are emerging, but it's yet to be determined how we're going to react to that. And I will say, there is something powerful about that notion. You know, the other thing about grand strategy, as Dr. Fever put in his article, is oftentimes no one pays attention to them unless they end in M-E-N-T. You know, you've got to have some little bumper sticker to describe it, or people just don't get interested in it. And yet, the idea of shifting our strategic priorities to the Pacific is probably profound enough for now. The two-war construct, as you know, we've said for decades, well, really since the fall of the wall and since the demise of the Soviet Union, we've said we have to be able to fight two nearly simultaneous wars. And we've taken that language out. Now, some people say, aha, you've taken that language out because now you're only going to fight one war. No, I didn't say that. And I would never say that. The nation doesn't need a military that can only do one thing at a time. The nation needs a military that can do multiple things at the same time based on the needs and to give the national command authority as many options as possible. So you might say, well, that's a cop-out. You can't really do that. I said, yeah, actually, I can. And I can because what we've done is this is the English major in me coming out, I suppose. We've actually freed ourselves from the tyranny of language associated with a two-war construct. Let me give you one example when I say the tyranny of language. So we had this two-war construct that said thou must fight two wars simultaneously. Okay, so I'm the chief staff of the Army, and I take the two potential scenarios. You know, at the time, potentially, this goes back several years now. One was Iraq for many years, and the other was Iran, and now or North Korea. But there was always two scenarios where we said, you must be prepared to fight. And so by the accounting rules of force distribution, you would apply combat power and then the enablers. And then the enablers, you'd have to make some judgments about, for example, how many days of supply of ammunition do you need? Remember now, tyranny of language. So not much wiggle room. You got to be able to fight two wars conventionally, nearly simultaneously. And by the time you were done with the accounting rules, the Army ended up with, and I'm not making this number up, 264,000 trucks. And you might say, that's absurd. How did you end up with 264,000 trucks? 3 days of supply of ammunition spread out over two conflicts for 3 days. I said that. 3 days of supply spread out over two conflicts. And it was a mathematical drill. So there truly was a tyranny to the two-war construct that was fine when the world was like that, and it was fine when resources were not an independent variable, but it's no longer fine. And so by freeing ourselves from that tyranny of vocabulary, I think what we've actually allowed ourselves to do now is to think differently about how we achieve the outcome, both in terms of scope and scale and over time. And we're not where we need to be yet. We've got distance to travel. But what I am suggesting to you is that by freeing ourselves from the tyranny of that particular language, I think you're going to find us to be a better force in the future. We got to keep it balanced. That means we got to invest in manpower, structure, modernization, training, maintenance, equipment, and military construction. And we'll do that. We got to invest in our leaders. If I had to pick one place on which the strategy will succeed or fail, it'll be on our ability to develop leaders to execute it. Because the reality is, no strategy will ever be executed exactly as we've written it, and it is the leaders in our armed forces who will adapt it and make it work in whatever circumstance they find themselves.
That's General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on Federal News Radio, making his first public comments about the new defense strategic guidance in a speech at Duke University. That's it for this week's show. If you missed our interview about the Pentagon strategy earlier in the hour, you can listen back at federalnewsradio.com. You'll also find links to the strategy and all the latest on DOD's efforts to implement budget cuts. Thanks for listening to On DOD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.